under full conscious control. Some magicians are said to have developed that level of ability as well, but as with the Siddhis, achieving conscious, robust control of super abilities is rare. One way to investigate if meditation really does amplify natural psi and magical skills is to ask meditators about their experiences. At the Institute of Noetic Sciences, my colleagues conducted a survey of more than 1,000 meditators to ask about their experiences. They found that 3 out of 4 reported increases in meaningful synchronicities as a result of their practice. Nearly half reported sensing non-physical entities, and a third reported experiences such as clairvoyance or telepathy. This suggests that meditation works as the yogic and other traditions claim it does, at least when it comes to subjective reports. The next step is to see if those experiences are supported by objective evidence. We'll address that question in Chapter 6. The bottom line? If you want to perform magic effectively, maintain a disciplined meditation practice. Learn to quiet your mind. See the world as it is, not as it appears to be when viewed through multiple layers of cultural conditioning. Force of will. It's unrealistic to expect that you'll become the legendary Merlin after lighting a candle and practicing meditation for 5 minutes. Throwing battle magic lightning bolts from your fingertips looks great in the movies, but for the majority of us, magic is expressed in subtle ways. Performing potent magic, like any refined skill, requires talent and disciplined practice. Perhaps you are the one in a million who's gifted with strong natural talent. If so, you'll be able to achieve dramatic effects fairly quickly. But the rest of us have to work at it. Fortunately, nearly anyone who's able to follow instructions and is serious about practicing can perform some degree of magic because, according to the esoteric worldview, whether you know it or not, within you there's a spark of the same source that manifests the entire universe. With that, as a brief introduction, here then are 2 variations for exercising your force of will: affirmations and sigils. Affirmations. Force of will magic involves the application of focused attention, intention, imagination, and belief. It's preposterously simple, but many claim that it works. We'll use a slightly elaborated example from the appropriately entitled book, It Works. This book provides a prime example of writing magic, one of the earliest forms of magical practice. The 4 steps are as follows. 1. Know what you want. The clearer the intended goal, the more likely it will manifest. Believe that the goal will be achieved. Imagine that it has already been achieved in the future, and it is inexorably headed your way. Write the goal on a piece of paper to focus your attention. Use a pen and paper exclusively reserved for this purpose. While writing, imagine that the surface of the paper represents universal consciousness and the ink represents your unconscious. As you write your goal, imagine that you are casting your unconscious intentions onto the medium that creates and sustains reality itself. 2. Review what you want. Review your goal daily. Between reviews, do not dwell on it. You want to strengthen your intention and keep it clear, but you also want to allow the goal to seep into your unconscious, because that's where magic is catalyzed. You may want to secure the writing paper with a special ribbon, or place it in a box set aside specifically for this purpose. 3. Maintain secrecy. Don't share your goal with others. They may inject doubt, and you need to maintain strong belief. 4. When it works, accept the outcome with gratitude and use it to strengthen your belief. This method, like any form of magical manifestation, is neutral with respect to morals or ethics. However, virtue is its own reward, and it's useful to keep in mind Spider-Man's motto, "With great power comes great responsibility." This means it would be morally questionable to use this technique to influence someone else, even in a way that you would consider to be positive, without that person's permission. In addition, from a pragmatic perspective, it is useful to begin with simple, easily measurable outcomes, like finding a small amount of money or achieving a modest goal. Avoid jumping straight away into grandiose schemes like world peace, not because it wouldn't work, at least in principle, but because gaining crystal clarity on what an accomplishment of that type of goal would mean, and how one would know if it happened, isn't as simple as it may seem. Sigils. Before considering how to create a sigil, a bit of background is in order. First, a sigil is simply a symbol for a desired goal. It has an advantage over writing because crafting a sigil requires more focused attention than just writing it, and because use of a symbolic goal reduces the grasp of the analytical mind. In addition, after the sigil is created, the magician traditionally charges and then releases it. The charging is meant to forcefully concentrate emotion, intention, and belief on the goal. The releasing is intended to push the goal from the conscious mind into the unconscious. There's another reason a sigil is useful as a magical tool. Consider the word spell. As a verb, spell means an action where symbols are combined to form larger symbols, which in turn refer to objects, actions, or concepts. That is, letters form words, form sentences. The magical meaning of the noun spell is similar to the meaning of the verb, except it assumes a worldview where everything is interconnected beyond space-time. This is the meaning of the magical law of correspondences. Now consider the word draw. One meaning of the verb draw is to devise a picture or a symbol. The other is to pull together. From the magical perspective, a symbol is more than something that points to a relationship. It's also an integral part of the structure of reality itself. By drawing a symbol, you pull the meaning of that symbol into existence. If the word symbol, Fido, corresponds to a real dog named Fido, then operations on the symbol will also influence the actual Fido. This is the concept underlying homeopathy, the wearing of good luck charms, and voodoo. Comb the hair of a doll made in the likeness of your distant friend, and your friend may thank you later about the wonderful new hairdo that she spontaneously decided to adopt. Note, this example is on the razor's edge of black magic, so don't try this at home. The idea that signs and symbols reflect, or literally are, the relational structure that holds the universe together was famously explored in Robert Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. The main character in that story, Valentin Michael Smith, was raised on Mars. In learning the Martian language, Smith gained powers that looked like magic. He taught others Martian words, and they too were able to gain these exceptional powers. A similar idea of an alien language evoking special powers was the leitmotif of the 2016 science fiction movie Arrival. In that story, the scientist who figures out how to interpret an alien language based on circular time begins to literally experience time differently. This notion jibes with informational interpretations of quantum theory, which we'll explore in more detail in Chapter 8. Perhaps the most famous of those interpretations was proposed by Princeton University physicist John Wheeler. He described it as the physics of it from bit, which means that an object in the physical world, an it, is derived from pure information, a bit, a digital representation of information. As Wheeler put it, every it, every particle, every field of force, even the space-time continuum itself, derives its function, its meaning, its very existence entirely, even if in some contexts indirectly, from the answers to yes or no questions, binary choices, bits. MIT physicist Max Tegmark generalized Wheeler's it from bit by proposing that physical reality literally is a mathematical structure, an abstract set of relationships. From that viewpoint, if one manipulates those abstract relationships, then one manipulates the physical world. That's the idea of a sigil and of force of will magic in general. Making and using a sigil. 1. Write your desire. Example, I find a $10 bill. 2. List the first letters of words in the sentence, ignoring words that begin with a vowel. You'll end up with FTDB. Fit the letters together into an abstract symbol. 4. Focus on the symbol, projecting either intense calm or intense emotion through the symbol to charge it and amplify your desire. Magicians provoke this charge within the state of gnosis through deep meditation by firing up a fierce concentration, by engaging in strong physical activity, by evoking anger, or by using the moment of sexual orgasm to provide an explosive point of focus. 5. After the sigil is charged, release your attention by putting the sigil away. Some magicians will go as far as to burn it. Others will momentarily glance at the sigil every so often, or place the symbol in a location where they'll see it now and then. The idea is to deflect the intention of the sigil from the conscious mind to the deep unconscious, where it will simmer and draw the desired outcome into being. 6. As with writing magic, maintaining strong belief is an important factor, as is secrecy. So keep the meaning of the sigil private and heed the age-old wisdom about using magic for benign purposes only. Does this really work? In my experience in both life and the lab, yes, it does. Not every time and not always with great fanfare, but it works often enough to raise an eyebrow. In life, the desired outcome usually manifests in the form of a meaningful synchronicity. In a laboratory study, it manifests as a statistically significant test of a hypothesis. The key elements in both cases are focused intention and openness to the idea that the desired outcome has already been achieved and very clear goals. Of course, there's a big difference between magic in everyday life and magic in the lab. With the latter, we know by design what is a chance versus a non-chance outcome. But with the former, there's no way to know for sure why a desired outcome occurred. Coincidences do occur. But occasionally, a synchronicity seems so unlikely that chance is no longer a viable explanation. I'll give an example of a four-part synchronicity. Synchronicity number one. Early in the year 2000, I was searching for office space for a research institute that a colleague, Richard Shoup, and I were establishing. We called it the Boundary Institute because its mission was to scientifically explore the boundaries between mind and matter using the disciplines of physics, mathematics, and computer science. This organization would continue a program of Psi research that I had been in charge of at a Silicon Valley technology company called Interval Research Corporation, funded by Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. The dot-com craze was at its peak at the time, with new internet startups popping up all over Silicon Valley. As a result, office rental rates, already at astronomical levels, were continuing to rise. We looked at four potential locations and ended up rejecting the first three because they were too expensive. That left only one clear choice, in the town of Los Altos, a suburb of Silicon Valley. It was a nice space with four offices, a common area, and a conference room, and it was located in a complex that housed accountants, therapists, real estate agents, dentists, and so on. The plan was that I would move in first and get things set up. After moving furniture into a room that would become my office, I became curious about our neighbors. I found a directory sign listing the office suites. Most were ordinary businesses, but one was named PsyQuest Incorporated. I took this as a delightful coincidence because our new institute was also a sort of PsyQuest, namely Psy Research of the parapsychological kind. There are only a handful of Psy Research facilities in the world, and we are all well aware of each other. So I was certain that the Psy in PsyQuest must have meant personnel service investigations or something like that. The Psy similarity was surely just an amusing coincidence. Synchronicity number two. About a month later, I took a new route to walk to our office and noticed that the sign on the suite next door to ours, which I hadn't noticed before, was PsyQuest Research Labs. Now, this was suddenly more interesting, because what in the world was personnel service investigations, as I imagined PsyQuest to be, doing with a research lab? The mini-blinds on the PsyQuest Research Labs window were closed, and what little I could see through the blinds revealed only a well-appointed reception space. No one was visible. I checked every day for the next 2 weeks. Finally, someone was in the PsyQuest Labs office. I knocked and tried the door. It was unlocked, so I entered and prepared to say hello to a man behind a desk. He looked up, and his eyes widened as though he saw a ghost. I thought maybe he was startled, so I extended my hand and said, "Hello, I wanted to introduce myself. I'm your neighbor next door. My name is..." But before I could finish, he managed to croak, "Dean Radin?" I hesitated. "Yes," I replied cautiously, wondering how he knew who I was and if he was feeling okay. He said nothing. He just continued to stare at me. After an uncomfortable pause, I said, "I'm your neighbor next door. I just wanted to introduce myself and see what kind of work you do here." After a moment, the man replied, "I'm doing what you're doing." Confused, I asked, "What do you think I'm doing?" He replied, "Psy research, parapsychology." Now it was my turn to stare, dumbfounded. Unbeknownst to me or to any of my colleagues around the world, here was another group engaged in the same kind of research that we were, and they were located next door to our new offices. Synchronicity number three. It turned out that the president of PsyQuest, John Kay, not only was thoroughly familiar with Psy research, but was specifically engaging in a magical practice to manifest me. John was using a Tibetan dream yoga technique, which involves alternating 3-hour periods of sleeping and waking over the course of 24 hours. During the waking periods, he was intensely wishing for a sign that his business was on the right track, and one of those signs would be for me to show up somehow, so I could join his board of directors. But he had no idea where I was or how to contact me. Hardly anyone at the time knew that I was living in Silicon Valley, and even fewer knew where our new institute was located. That's why when I opened the door to John's lab that day, he was speechless. He couldn't tell if he was awake or dreaming. From his perspective, my appearance on his doorstep was literally an act of magic based on his clear, repeated affirmations. When he was finally able to tell me what was going on, I too felt seriously disoriented. We both had to sit down. Synchronicity number four. The month before all this unfolded, I was focused on visualizing what our new offices and laboratory space would look like. I was drawing sketches of my ideal lab configuration on the whiteboard in my office, and imagining a certain kind of reclining leather chair, a shielded room, and other types of equipment that would be useful to have in the lab. I knew all this would be expensive, and our budget was limited, so I figured we wouldn't be able to afford it in the short term. But that didn't stop me from visualizing what I wanted. Returning to the story, after recovering from the shock of our meeting, John invited me to tour the rest of his facility. As we moved from one room to the next, I could hardly believe my eyes. John had the reclining leather chair, the shielded chamber, and all the other pieces of laboratory equipment I had been actively imagining. And all of it was located on the other side of the wall from my desk, no more than 6 feet from where I had been sketching what our lab would look like. I literally drew what I wanted into being. A half-baked speculation. After discussing that series of synchronicities with the other members of our institute, we agreed that this couldn't be a case of dumb luck. It's as though sustained intention on the part of John and myself had acted as a sort of force that drew PsyQuest and the Boundary Institute together, analogous to gravity drawing a moon and a planet together. In Einstein's general relativistic concept of gravity, the planet doesn't reach out with gravity beams to pull on the moon. Rather, the fabric of space-time is distorted by the planet's mass, and the warped geometry naturally guides the moon and the planet to drift toward each other. Later I'll describe an experiment we did that more formally explored this idea. With this analogy in mind, we thought that perhaps intense intention also warps or distorts aspects of reality. Events that might otherwise be completely separate and never meet are naturally drawn, incorporating both meanings of the verb to draw, together by the resulting warp in space-time. Like magic. Divination. Divination involves perceiving beyond the ordinary boundaries of space and time. In the early 19th century, this ability was called clairvoyance, French for clear seeing. Later, it was called extrasensory perception, or ESP. Today, the euphemism remote viewing is more commonly used. Training techniques to help develop remote viewing abilities were designed by artist Ingo Swann as part of a classified program of Psi research funded by the U.S. government from 1972 to 1995. Swann based his picture drawing technique on methods used in the 1880s by British researchers Frederick W. H. Myers and Edmund Gurney, in the 1920s by the American social activist Upton Sinclair, and in the 1940s by British psychologist Whately Carrington and French researcher René Warcollier. The method involves making fast, abstract sketches of impressions gained when asked to mentally perceive a distant target image or location. This is intended to capture not only fleeting visual images, but impressions from the other senses as well. The reason Swann's technique focused on fast sketching, at least in the initial stages of remote viewing, is that the single greatest inhibitor of remote viewing ability is the analytic mind, which gets in the way. In the jargon used in this type of training, this problem is called an analytical overlay. To explain, let's say our task is to use remote viewing to describe a hidden or distant target. A taskmaster assigns the target a randomly assigned label, say X2395, which is associated with the real target. This association can be accomplished by simply placing the label on an envelope containing a photo of the target. Now, let's say the target is a person wearing a yellow raincoat. When a remote viewer directs her attention toward that target, she might instantly perceive a vague flash of something yellow. But then, within a fraction of a second, the analytical portion of her mind will jump in and associate that bit of information with typically yellow things. Before she's even consciously aware of it, she'll start thinking that the target is a banana. And once that thought enters her mind, it's extremely difficult to let it go. other than using meditation to achieve a state where these flashes of information are not overwhelmed by the buzz of everyday thoughts, learning to not name the target is the primary challenge one faces in remote viewing training. For reasons that make sense in evolutionary terms, over millions of years, our brains have been hardwired to take a pinch of information and instantly fill in the blanks with the most likely description. The reason is simple. If you see a glimmer of black and orange stripes out of the corner of your eye, your brain will instantly assume it's a tiger and your legs will start running before you realize it. If your assumption is wrong, you'll get a momentary scare and it won't matter much. But if you're right, it could save your life. In the wild, you survive by acting first and thinking later. But for more subtle types of perception, like remote viewing, that same tendency has to be unlearned. This is what Swan's method taught. One of his earliest techniques, designed to baffle the analytical mind, was called coordinate remote viewing, because the only information provided about the target was map coordinates. Without thinking about it or looking at a map, what's your impression of what's located at 37.819732 degrees latitude and negative 122.478762 degrees longitude? Later techniques by Swan used more abstract targeting methods, like the randomly constructed label X2395. And that worked just as well. After the secret government program was declassified, variations of the original training methods were developed and taught by former members of the U.S. Army's remote viewing unit. As time went by, variations of the original method were developed by second and third generation students who capitalized on the burgeoning popular interest in remote viewing training. Each new method seems to carry increasingly bolder claims about its amazing new and improved super-duper double-secret enhanced learning technique, but the essence of all these various methods is the same. Remote viewing training. Swan's original technique was based on a series of stages that I've simplified into 8 steps. We'll assume that you have no idea what the target is or where it's located. It might be a photograph inside a sealed envelope, a person who will travel tomorrow to a location only she knows, or an object that a friend lost a week ago. To make the exercise useful as an experiment, you'll eventually need to know what the right answer is, otherwise you won't be able to tell if the remote viewing attempt was accurate. This method may be easier if the remote viewing session includes a partner who can guide you through the various stages. In that way, you won't need to engage the portion of your mind that's required to keep track of the process. Most classroom remote viewing training, as well as most of the operational remote viewing employed in the U.S. government program, used a human interviewer for this reason. Obviously, in a valid experiment, the interviewer can't know anything about the target either. For a novice, this process may take a half hour or more. For an expert, it can take 5 minutes. The 8 steps are as follows. 1. Start with a blank piece of paper and a pencil. Holding the target in mind, quickly draw lines, curves, or squiggles. Don't think about it. Just sketch the first thing that comes into your mind. Remote viewing information initially appears as a very brief impression, a flash, a mere glimmer. It's not like watching a full-color 3D IMAX movie. Also, your sketch might reflect how you feel about the target and have nothing to do with what the target looks like. So don't analyze what you've drawn. Just quickly sketch while keeping your goal in mind. Describe the target. 2. List your initial sensory impressions of the target, focusing on movement, odor, taste, touch, and sound. After listing those, add any visual impressions that come to mind, including shape and color. The moment you realize that you've named an impression, note it, but add that it's AOL, for analytical overlay. 3. Mentally examine the target from other perspectives, from far away, close up, low, and high. Capture the impressions you gain from each new perspective. Avoid naming the impressions. 4. Note any emotional feelings you may have about the target. 5. Combine all the impressions you've gained so far and use them to make a sketch or a series of sketches that describe the target. Now, based on your accumulated perceptions, write down what you think the target is. This is the first step where analysis should be used. 6. Mentally re-examine the target and look for anything you may have missed. Watch for new insights, novel feelings, surprising elements, or any other aspect that might feel out of place. Sketch and write down these impressions. 7. Compare your sketch of the target with any new information you've gained. Revise if necessary. 8. Now compare the actual target with your final description. Factors involved in enhancing remote viewing performance or improving divination skills of any sort were studied by parapsychologist Rhea White in the 1960s. She focused on reports by individuals who had consistently demonstrated high-level psi performance to see if there were any similarities. She found a number of them. 1. Relax. Achieve a state of deep physical relaxation. 2. Stabilize the mind. Meditation may be helpful in encouraging what some adepts refer to as a blank mental screen, or what a magician might call the initial stages of achieving gnosis. The goal is to avoid mind wandering. 3. Direct the mind. After achieving a period of mental stability, ask yourself, what is the target? The idea is to direct the mind, which at this point should be in a calm, blank, or idling mode, so it can focus without distraction on the task at hand. 4. Wait with expectation. To explain this, Rhea White recounted a metaphor of the winding of a toy top as a preliminary to its spinning. That is, don't just wait passively. Create a sense of tension, belief, and excitement that the information will arrive. Be patient and don't force it. 5. Look for a feeling of conviction. To help discriminate between mind-generated fantasies and acquisition of genuine information, you may notice that when the impression is correct, it is accompanied by a strong feeling of conviction or by a burst of joy, vividness, or certainty. In today's fast-paced world, we want instant results. 5 steps times 30 seconds is 2.5 minutes. Who has that kind of time to spare? The talented people that Rhea White studied would sometimes spend an hour or more on a single trial. 15 minutes to relax, a half hour to create a mental blank screen, then another half hour before perceiving target information and knowing that it was correct. Sometimes no suitable impression would arrive, so there goes an hour, wasted. You could have been watching the latest cat videos on YouTube and enjoying a refreshing beverage and a biscotti. Magic is real, but no one said it's going to be fast or easy. Theurgy, calling all spirits. Why is it when we talk to God it's called praying, but if God talks back, it's called schizophrenia? Jane Wagner. People have different reactions to the concept that there are disembodied spirits around us all the time. For those who believe in guardian angels, or that their departed loved ones are still present in some form, the idea can be comforting. For those who've been frightened by tales of demons, the same idea is horrific. There are endless stories about such entities, and a case can be made that all of it, from legends of the wee people, fairies, and forest sprites, to tales of angels, demons, and even extraterrestrial aliens and UFO encounters, arises from a common source. But so far, scientific evidence that such experiences involve intelligent, independent, non-physical entities, as opposed to a mixture of human-centric psi and psychological effects, has not been established in such a way that people who are intimately familiar with the evidence and even sympathetic to the idea of entities will reach the same conclusion. In my opinion, the scientific jury is still out regarding the reality of such spirits or entities. Of course, my hesitation doesn't mean that such entities don't exist. It just means that we don't have methods yet that can strictly discriminate between psi effects in the living and independent, disembodied intelligences. Some claim that we can communicate with spirits using electronic devices and computers, and some of the evidence for what is known as electronic voice phenomena or instrumental transcommunication, ITC, is intriguing. But there, too, the methods do not strictly exclude explanations based on psi. One source of information about electronic methods used in this line of research is the ITC Journal, run by Dr. Annabella Cardoso. As far as the practice of theurgy goes, the act of evoking spirits, it should not be taken lightly that ghosts and demons are indispensable plot points in horror films, or that skeptics laugh at the notion of disembodied spirits, even if that laugh is nervous and one eye twitches uncontrollably. The esoteric literature on theurgy suggests that if you don't know what you're doing, don't do it. There are plenty of books on theurgic spells and ceremonial rituals that appear to be relatively benign. But given that scientific guidance for these practices is so thin as compared to the other two classes of magic, and because of the potential psychological consequences of shattering your belief system by encountering something that scares your pants off, I will pass on providing practical exercises. This is a topic that requires expertise and wisdom, and because of that, it's inadvisable to learn from a book. Don't say I didn't warn you. Chapter 6. Scientific Evidence. The only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little way past them into the impossible. Arthur C. Clarke. The scientific literature relevant to understanding magic has been published in peer-reviewed journals over the past century and a half. It consists of roughly 3,000 laboratory experiments, each of which involved one or more researchers testing anywhere from a handful to hundreds of participants over years or even decades. With very few exceptions, these experiments were not designed to test magical concepts. They were conducted in the context of applying scientific methods to investigate psi experiences. But when these same studies are viewed through the lens of the esoteric traditions, testing magic is exactly what these experiments were all about. Force of will has been studied in the context of investigating mind-matter interactions, also called psychokinesis. Divination has been studied as variations of clairvoyance or precognition. Theurgy has been investigated in the laboratory, typically in the form of mediumship studies. From a mainstream scientific perspective, the existence of psi phenomena remains controversial. Some claim that the persistent debate indicates that despite a century of smoke, there's still no fire, and so psi probably doesn't exist. For stronger skeptics, all of the supporting scientific evidence, 100% of it, can be due only to flukes, flaws, or fraud. I am confident that the dismissive skeptical opinion is wrong. In my opinion, the primary reason for the continuing uncertainty is due to assumptions about the nature of reality that are formalized within the scientific worldview. If one completely accepts today's worldview as inviolate or absolute, then the strength and quality of the evidence for psi simply don't matter. The phenomena are considered impossible, and that's that. This may be surprising to those who've been taught that science is dispassionately rational and evidence-based. Science certainly aspires to be driven by evidence, but as in any domain of human affairs, a few leading figures in each discipline establish fads and fashions that others are expected to follow. Those same figures enforce the status quo by deciding who gets promoted and who gets grants to fund their research. This helps to define the boundaries of each discipline, but of course it also constrains genuine innovation. The realpolitik of science is a fascinating subject, and it's central in understanding why psi and magic are taboo within the academic world. But it also threatens to deflect us from our main interest, so I'll set it aside for now and instead address the evidence from a different perspective. An expert analysis. The mathematical discipline that specializes in the evaluation of experimental data is statistics. Professor Jessica Utz is chair of the statistics department at the University of California at Irvine. In 2016, she was also president of the American Statistical Association, ASA, the world's largest community of professional statisticians. In her presidential address to the ASA, speaking at a meeting attended by 6,000 statisticians from 62 countries around the world, Utz said something that undoubtedly surprised many of the attendees. I quote a segment of her talk at length because it's directly relevant to understanding the evidence for psi. She said the following. For many years, I have worked with researchers doing very careful work in parapsychology, including a year that I spent full-time working on a classified project for the United States government to see if we could use these abilities for intelligence gathering during the Cold War. At the end of that project, I wrote a report for Congress stating what I still think is true. The data in support of precognition and possibly other related phenomena are quite strong statistically and would be widely accepted if it pertained to something more mundane. Yet most scientists reject the possible reality of these abilities without ever looking at data. And on the other extreme, there are true believers who base their beliefs solely on anecdotes and personal experience. I have asked the debunkers if there is any amount of data that would convince them, and they generally have responded by saying, probably not. I ask them what original research they have read, and they mostly admit that they haven't read any. Now there is a definition of pseudoscience, basing conclusions on belief rather than data. When I have given talks on this topic to audiences of statisticians, I show lots of data. Then I ask the audience, which would be more convincing to you, lots more data or one strong personal experience? Almost without fail, the response is one strong personal experience. I think people are justifiably skeptical because most people think that these abilities contradict what we know about science. They don't, but that's the subject for a different talk. Six Sigma. Another take on the overall evidence for psi is provided by classes of experiments that have exceeded the Six Sigma threshold. This refers to studies where the overall odds against chance, after careful consideration of all known experiments investigating the same topic, are assessed to be over 1,000,000,000 to 1. Each of these experiments used protocols that avoided all known design flaws. An extensive due diligence list of possible design faults has developed after years of intense scrutiny and criticism of these studies, leading to bulletproof designs. Each class of experiments has been repeated from a dozen to more than 100 times by independent investigators at different labs around the world, with each class cumulatively involving hundreds to thousands of participants. The vast majority of these studies involved ordinary people, most of whom were not claiming any special psi abilities. This recruitment strategy was employed in most cases for pragmatic reasons. It is expensive to find and work with highly talented specialists, but it also provides an important benefit because the results are not based on extraordinary claims. That is, tests involving celebrity psychics inevitably invite attacks because it's easier for critics to believe that those individuals were just clever tricksters rather than genuinely talented. The other advantage of working with ordinary people is that the resulting evidence then applies to the general population. In other words, we're talking not about X-Men, but about what is true among the general population. Classes of experiments. The six classes of scientific experiments with overall strong positive evidence are telepathy, specifically an experimental protocol called the Ganzfeld, for testing the existence of conscious telepathic impressions between pairs of isolated people. This experiment has been repeated by dozens of investigators around the world for four decades, including by avowed skeptics who, to their consternation and surprise, successfully replicated the effect. Remote viewing, otherwise known as clairvoyance and precognition, a method for testing perception that transcends space or time. Presentiment, a technique for measuring unconscious physiological reactions to future events. Implicit precognition, a test that measures future influences on present time behavior. This type of study was popularized by Cornell University psychologist Daryl Bem. Random number generators, RNGs, a laboratory protocol used to test if mental intention affects the outputs of random physical systems. This is a more refined version of older tests involving tossed dice. An RNG is an electronic device designed to produce truly random sequences of zeros and ones, each with probability 1 to 2, like an automated coin flipper. The source of randomness in these devices is not a software algorithm, but true random events, such as electron tunneling in electronic circuit components. Tunneling is a quantum mechanical phenomenon considered in physics to be fundamentally random. Global Consciousness Project, a worldwide version of an RNG experiment where the outputs of RNGs located around the world are compared against long-term baselines during events of major global interest, for example, terrorist attacks. This experiment differs from the previous five classes because it doesn't involve individuals studied in the laboratory, but rather is a global experiment including everyone. It also tests not the effects of intention, but rather the simultaneous, focused attention of millions of people. All of the data from this project have been publicly available through its website from 1998, when the project began. After collecting 500 worldwide events, which took 18 years, because, fortunately, major worldwide events don't happen very often, the experiment had achieved an overall result above 7 sigma. That's associated with odds against chance greater than 1 trillion to 1. Other classes of studies that haven't reached the 6 sigma level yet, but may do so after enough data are collected, include experiments investigating the effects of distant mental influence on human physiology and behavior. In one variation of this type of experiment, a total of 51 experiments were conducted between 1977 and 2000 by multiple investigators at different labs around the world. The experiments involved more than 1,000 pairs of participants, with one member of each pair attempting to mentally influence the other's physiological state. The combined results were odds against chance of 15,600 to 1. The second type of experiment involved a laboratory test of Obi-Wan Kenobi's Jedi mind trick, as memorialized in his famous line in the first Star Wars movie, "These aren't the droids you're looking for." These experiments explored if one person's intention could cloud or distract another person's mind. In a combined 576 test sessions, the associated odds against chance in these studies were a modest but statistically meaningful 100 to 1. In sum, when considering Utz's statements to the world's statisticians, the six classes of experimental protocols that exceed combined odds against chance of 1 billion to 1, and two other protocols headed in that direction, there is no need for further proof-oriented scientific evidence. Debates will persist over ways to best explain and interpret these data, but the existential question that some forms of psi exist is, for all practical purposes, settled. And that means what we've called magic, because we don't know what else to call it yet, also exists. In the rest of this chapter, we'll explore how certain aspects of magical lore have been studied in the laboratory. We'll look at experiments that have investigated how the force of will works, the role of belief in modulating performance, studies on divining the future, the power of collective consciousness, the law of correspondences, and evidence of communication with non-physical entities. Most of the following studies were not endlessly repeated like the Six Sigma experiments. I've reviewed those proof-oriented studies in other books, so there's no need to repeat them here. Instead, we're interested in experiments that were designed to probe beyond the edge of the known and into the frontiers of magic. Force of will. Quantum consciousness. A February 2017 Big Questions article in the BBC's online magazine BBC Earth was on the topic of the strange link between the human mind and quantum physics. It reviewed the observer effect in quantum mechanics, whereby observing an elementary quantum object, such as a photon or an electron, affects its behavior. This shyness effect, which is well accepted in physics, but still quite mysterious, is thought by some to have something to do with consciousness. The BBC article describes that possibility, but then disparages what it calls the New Age cottage industry for using quantum concepts to support ideas like psychic phenomena. The popular association between what skeptics have labeled quantum flapdoodle and actual quantum physics makes it difficult for legitimate physicists interested in the observer effect to propound on its implications. But not everyone is so reticent. Adrian Kent is a respected professor of quantum physics at the University of Cambridge. In an interview with the BBC, Kent proposed that it might be possible that consciousness affects the behavior of quantum systems, and that someday it might even be possible to detect such effects in laboratory experiments. He then went out on a limb and cautiously predicted that there might be a 15% chance that his proposal was correct and a 3% chance that this would be confirmed within the next half century. That's very exciting. It's too bad we have to wait 50 years to learn if consciousness is related to physics. Then again, maybe we don't have to wait that long. We've already seen that one of the Six Sigma classes of psi experiments involves testing the effect of intention on RNGs, where the randomness is based on quantum properties. Hundreds of such experiments have been published since the 1960s. In 2003, the effect was even successfully replicated by a staunch skeptic. Starting in 2008, my colleagues and I began a series of experiments to look more closely at the quantum observer effect. In journals including Physics Essays and Quantum Biosystems, we described 17 experiments using various types of optical systems to test, as Adrian Kent proposed, whether consciousness would affect the behavior of quantum systems in a detectable way. Most of our experiments used double-slit optical systems. These are elegantly simple devices used extensively in physics to explore the quantum nature of photons, particles of light. They consist of a source of light, two tiny parallel slits that light can pass through, and a camera that records the resulting pattern of light. The source of light might be an incandescent bulb or a laser, both of which can produce umpteen trillions of photons per second. Or it might be a fancier arrangement that's designed to generate one photon at a time. The two slits in our optical setups were about 200 microns, millionths of a meter, apart, and each slit was about 10 microns wide. The camera can be a high-resolution digital camera, or it might be a device called a line camera, which has a line of sensors all in a row, each of which is extremely sensitive to variations in light intensity. The reason this simple setup is so popular is because it's easy to mathematically describe the behavior of light in the apparatus and also because it's a convenient way to demonstrate the quantum observer effect. This effect refers to the fact that the light pattern produced by this apparatus differs depending on whether one knows, or can know in principle, if the photons pass through the left slit or the right slit. If you know, then the pattern that the camera sees is what one would expect if the photons were acting like little particles. But if you don't know, then the pattern looks like the photons were behaving like waves. This wave-like versus particle-like difference suggests that there's something peculiar about the role of observation, and that strangeness opens the door to the possibility that consciousness and the physical world might interact in fundamental ways. Overall, our experiments suggest that what Adrian Kent was pondering is in fact true. The overall odds against chance in our series of studies range from a conservative 27,000 to 1 to a liberal 17,000 trillion to 1, depending on the assumptions used when combining the experimental results. Four of our double-slit systems used continuous beam lasers as the source of photons. One used a light source that produced one photon at a time. We even ran a series of experiments over the Internet to study the role of distance between the participants and the optical system. More than 1,500 people participated in that study over the course of 3 years. Some were as far as 18,000 kilometers away from our laboratory. We found that the distance between the participants and the optical systems didn't matter. The average effects were the same, regardless of distance. Two independent physicists reviewed our raw data from these experiments, and both confirmed that our reported results were correct. Of greater significance, a series of independent replications of our work by a physicist at the University of São Paulo in Brazil were highly successful. A talk I gave at a conference in April 2016 that summarized our 17 studies was posted on YouTube, and as of July 2017, it had been viewed over 500,000 times. The role of resonance. A series of experiments at the University of Edinburgh in the 1970s and 1980s used RNGs to explore mind-matter interactions. Participants were asked what kinds of mental strategies they used and which ones produced the best outcomes. The most successful participants reported that a subjective sense of resonance, or feeling at one with the RNG, was the key factor. Another was the paradoxical concept of effortless striving. This means you must absolutely want the desired outcome more than anything you've ever desired, a passionate, obsessive, overwhelming desire. But at exactly the same time, you must also maintain zero anxiety about it. This contradictory state is by no means easy to achieve, but it does bear similarity to states that can be achieved in meditation, visualization exercises, and focused concentration. Of the different intentional strategies participants used in the RNG studies, the most successful in terms of their actual performance were, in decreasing order, resonance, then asking entities, spirits or angels, for assistance, using emotion to help power the will, one-pointed concentration, physical relaxation, visual imagery, and finally, talking to the RNG as though it was a sentient creature, much as children might talk to their teddy bears or as a car mechanic might talk to a misbehaving engine. Princeton University's PAIR Laboratory, active from 1979 to 2007, conducted a long series of RNG studies, and they too asked the participants what strategies they were using when they got the best response from the RNG. Their comments were similar to those found at Edinburgh. A state of immersion in the process which leads to a loss of awareness of myself and the immediate surroundings. Similar to the experience of being absorbed in a game, book, theatrical performance, or some creative occupation. I don't feel any direct control over the device, more like a marginal influence when I'm in resonance with the machine. It's like being in a canoe. When it goes where I want, I flow with it. When it doesn't,